Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast, designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as explore solutions and interview problem solvers in the industry.
Welcome into CoreCast Episode 2, as we continue to discuss the affordable housing crisis in America. As you know, CoreCast is brought to you by National Community Renaissance, or National Core, one of the largest affordable housing developers in the nation. My name is Jonathan Kendrick, and I'm here again with Steve Pontell, my co-host and the CEO and president of National Core. Steve, it's good to be with you again.
Likewise, Jonathan. Thank you.
And Steve, we have a packed episode today. We're really excited to get into this. We're going to have, as our guest a little bit later, Supervisor Kurt Hagman of San Bernardino County. We're also going to have our legislative update provided by Michael Novogradic. And before we get to that, we'll have our usual topic, our water cooler discussion. And this week, it's going to be framed around an interesting report released this week by the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. Each year, they release an annual report titled The State of the Nation's Housing. And we'll begin with a more general discussion, and then we'll get a little bit more into their findings on affordable housing and how National Core is involved in combating the problems highlighted in the Harvard report. Before we get to that, some of the general findings that came out of this report, and this has been published widely, a lot of interest follows this report every year. The home ownership rate is now at the lowest it's been since 1993. It's around 63% now, and back in 2004 was up by 69%. On the flip side to that, rental demand has been extremely strong. Vacancy rates are as low as they've been in nearly 20 years. Construction of new single-family homes are near historic lows. So Steve, as a person that has his finger on the pulse of the economy and the housing market, how have you seen these trends play out across our nation? And, you know, really this movement from home ownership to rentals across many places.
Well, a lot of it is driven by the current economic condition. And as the economy gets stronger and people are able to replenish assets that were lost during the downturn, I think you'll see people moving back into home ownership. But the other big challenge that we have is the entire millennial generation currently is, you can say, handcuffed by their student debt to the extent they have it. And so the challenges that they're facing in their ability to enter into the homeownership market are huge. And so that's delaying the normal demand that would be in place just based on age and family formation. And so as we go forward, though, the other big stumbling block are the distortions that are made in the marketplace that drive up the cost of housing. And it's interesting to think about it from a couple of perspectives. One is that, you know, historically, housing was a locally generated product with a lot of community-based local builders, and they tended to build housing to meet all price ranges. As housing has become more national and the builders more public, what you're finding is builders that are interested in maximizing their margins, rationally so, on the production of housing. And so they're trying to build housing for the highest price point that they can sell it for. And so we're building housing for the higher end of the market and not thinking about how does the market produce more cost-effective housing, which makes the barrier to entry that much higher. So all of these dynamics are at work that are essentially slowing the opportunities for home ownership, forcing more people into the renter market. And the overall challenge from a price standpoint is just the sheer lack of supply. You know, nationwide, we have a dramatic shortage of the supply. And anytime you short the supply of a product, you're going to drive up the prices.
And one of the effects of this crisis has been the cost burden of housing. And that's increase and the increasing nature of that on both homeowners and renters. Amongst renters in 2013, almost half of renters in the United States paid more than 30% of their income on housing, and that's kind of been the traditional threshold that analysts have used as the cost burden. If you pay more than 30% of your take-home income on housing, they say your cost burden, and now over half of our nation, in the rental market at least, I mean, close to a quarter of the nation and homeowners now have passed that threshold. And Steve, how does that then impact those people and our economy as a whole?
Well, just to compound it, it's not only the increased percentage of family income going to houses, but also essentially now the requirement in order for families to be able to afford housing to have two wage earners within the family. And so you've had a double hit on families where it used to be the case that a single wage earner essentially was able to afford housing with 30% of their income. Now it requires two wage earners, and they struggle to afford their housing within 30% of their income. The impact of that is, you know, a loss of disposable income for other activities that the family would normally undertake, more stress and strain on the family. And then you combine that with transportation costs, which are similarly increasing, you know, with the price of fuel and other constraints, and you'll see families that are exceeding 50% at a growing rate when you add in housing and transportation. And in some markets, it's much higher than that, which then drives multiple families having to live together in order to be able to afford housing. If we don't crack the code and provide an adequate supply of housing, ultimately this problem will get tougher and tougher to solve as we go forward.
Now, one of the tools used to combat this affordability crisis is what we call affordable housing or subsidized housing, the main function of what we do here at National Core. And some interesting news regarding that and highlighted as well in this report. They said in the report, quote, federal assistance lags far behind need. Although funding for things like housing choice vouchers did increase in recent years, the costs of subsidies also rose, limiting growth in the number of federally assisted households. There's been severe cuts to the home program, which have hampered the ability of state and local governments to add new assisted units. And then the affordability periods of more than 2 million assisted housing units are set to expire over the coming decade. And the big news this week was the Senate Appropriations Committee in Washington passed their funding bill for HUD and transportation agencies, in which they were going to cut home funding. This program that provides affordable housing is one source of funding, from $900 million in fiscal year 2015 down to $66 million in fiscal year 2016. So, Steve, reactions to that, and then more broadly, what is the role of affordable or subsidized housing to combat this greater problem of the affordability of housing?
Sure. There will always be a need for subsidized housing for certain population groups, but the need for subsidized housing grows when the cost of housing continues to rise so dramatically. So the more the market is distorted on the cost of housing, the more the need for subsidy is going to grow. And so I think that's something we really need to get our mind around, is if we're going to distort the cost side of the production of housing through additional building requirements, through additional environmental controls, through local controls, through additional fees, then the need for subsidy will continue to grow as well. And unfortunately, what you see happening with the subsidies is, number one, they're being cut pretty dramatically at the exact time they need to grow. But number two, they tend to be moving towards more either state control or federal control. So the number of resources that local government has available to try and facilitate affordable housing within their communities are shrinking. And the home funds are a perfect example of that. The home funds are one of the best tools for states and local regions to be able to help provide additional funding for affordable housing. And to the extent the home funds are cut and the resources are increasingly allocated from either the state or the federal, local ability to facilitate housing is going to continue to shrink. And local government is going to know best how and where for affordable housing would do the most good. And so the challenges we face: continued increases in the cost of producing housing, continued reduction in funds available to subsidize housing, continued need growth for housing, paints a pretty challenging picture for the future. We do not currently have any answers at the state level or the local level to provide adequate housing for the population that we have today. And from my perspective, that's the height of irresponsibility.
So you mentioned this a little bit in passing there, the idea of local governments having a better idea of where to invest. And so, you know, there's the idea or the question of how much to invest, as we just discussed, but also the where, and this being really an interesting academic debate across the country now, that's dividing into somewhat into two camps. First, some statistics from this Harvard report on distressed neighborhoods and areas where there's high disinvestment. So they say that home prices across the country are within 11% of their previous peak nationally. However, there's a tenth of the nation's zip codes where the prices are still more than 35% below their peak. These neighborhoods, they have 26% of homeowners are underwater on their mortgages. That's double the national share. They account for roughly half of all seriously delinquent loans nationwide. And these places have disproportionately large shares of minority and low-income residents. These are places where National Core has done a lot of work and continues to do so. But there's kind of this debate now whether the best good is going into these neighborhoods and investing resources to turn them around, to spur other investment, catalytic investment, or whether this investment, continued investment in these neighborhoods will lead to a concentration of poverty, and whether it's better off moving people around, taking people out of these neighborhoods and kind of, balancing things out, as it were. Steve, your thoughts on that kind of debate as it comes across the country?
Sure. The disparate impact challenge is a legitimate dialogue to have. Nobody today believes that the historic public housing concentrations are a good idea. And so almost all of the affordable housing deals going forward are either mixed income or they're intended to be catalytic for the transformation of a neighborhood, not a place to concentrate poverty and essentially structurally create neighborhoods that are never able to transition out of that poverty. But really, taking a step back, it falls into a couple of categories of challenge. Number one, housing is not an easily movable asset. And unfortunately, the economy is an increasingly dynamic, geographically dynamic element. And so the economy in certain areas may be booming, while the economy in other areas are declining. And people still tend to follow where the economic opportunities are. So you can have some cities that have thousands and thousands of vacant housing units, but they don't have an economy to attract the labor, the workforce, to be able to occupy those housing. Meanwhile, you have booming places that have a shortage of housing. And so that's one of the challenges, is you can't look at national statistics and percentages. You have to understand what's going on in certain local communities in order to be able to really see what the impact is as we go forward. But it is the case that we need to think beyond housing when it comes to neighborhood transformation, where housing can be a catalytic tool, and especially new investment in housing for the transformation of challenged neighborhoods. And there are many cities and many projects where this is proven out. And so one of the challenges, if you take the disparate impact argument and say all new public investment can only go into majority neighborhoods, so majority Caucasian neighborhoods, then what you're taking away is new public investment from challenged neighborhoods, where that public investment could be the critical piece for transforming the neighborhood. And so as we go forward, the hope is that we can have thoughtful, intelligent analysis and understanding how can public investment be used appropriately to transform neighborhoods, and not assume that the intent or the ultimate goal will just be the increased concentration of poverty in those currently challenged neighborhoods.
So the disparate impact that you were mentioning came down in a Supreme Court ruling within the last few weeks. The Supreme Court ruling in a 5-4 decision that disparate impact claims can be used to support claims of alleged Fair Housing Act violations. This was a lawsuit coming from Texas, the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, against the Inclusive Communities Project, which challenged the construction of low-income housing predominantly in inner-city minority neighborhoods in the city of Dallas rather than in Caucasian suburbs on the grounds of a violation of the Fair Housing Act of 1968. So many housing industry groups have come out and said this is an important affirmation of the Fair Housing Act, but they've also offered a word of caution on how it could affect affordable housing development and investment in distressed neighborhoods. Bart Mitchell, who's the CEO of the Community Builders, said, while the positive impact of the decision likely means more poor families will have broader access to safe suburbs with good schools, the ruling, if misapplied by states, could starve underserved inner-city communities of critical housing resources. And Steve, I know this is an issue that you've been thinking through as well as it relates to some of our work. Your reactions to the ruling, and then how, as Bart Mitchell of the Community Builders was saying, how we can prevent against this being misused against the people that it's very, trying to protect.
Right. And just, I completely agree with what Bart said and echoing what I said a minute ago, it would be unfortunate if the result of this was to divert necessary public investment away from those neighborhoods that need it the most, especially when it could be used in a catalytic way. Some of the, I think, opportunities is the Supreme Court ruling also indicated that you could not just use the statistical percentages of minority populations or socioeconomic conditions as the sole determinant of a disparate impact. And so it is our hope that the argument and the ability to represent how the investment is going to be catalytic to transform the neighborhood would still be a very important part of the consideration. Otherwise, the Fair Housing Act will be used to really have a negative impact on currently challenging neighborhoods, because without the public investment, it's very unlikely that private investment will be attracted into those neighborhoods.
And then to tie up this section, as you know, we are an affordable housing developer that not just talks about these issues, but actually tries to do something about them. And right now, an excellent example of this is our Waterman Gardens revitalization in the city of San Bernardino. And Steve, if you could talk a little bit about the theory behind that, the goal in going into this area, partnering with the Housing Authority of the County of San Bernardino and several other public partners to revitalize this area.
Sure. So the city of San Bernardino is currently having its own challenges that are well documented. And we hope the city best, and we actually believe the city of San Bernardino actually has a very bright future. Its location is ideal, its transportation resources are strong, and as the economy grows, we believe the city of San Bernardino will benefit and prosper as well. There are neighborhoods within the city of San Bernardino that have historically been challenged and continue to struggle. What we saw in the Waterman Gardens project was the opportunity to do what we were just talking about through intelligent, strategic public investment in the provision of quality, affordable housing with services that help those residents enter into the market. There will be an attraction of public investment into a neighborhood that would, a private investment into a neighborhood that would not attract that investment if not for seeing changes occur within the neighborhood itself. Unfortunately, we have some statistical challenges in the neighborhood, and the FHEO Office of HUD, Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity Office of HUD, is concerned about the over-concentration of investment and the creation of additional subsidized housing in a challenged neighborhood. And so we're in conversation with them to prove the point about this investment is absolutely the right thing to do in this neighborhood, not only to produce new housing for the current public housing residents within the neighborhood, but to use that investment to be catalytic as we go forward. The opportunities in this neighborhood include partnering with the education establishment and increasing the access to and quality of education, partnering with the healthcare establishment to increase access and wellness within the neighborhood, employment development opportunities. And so all of those conversations are being facilitated as a result of the investment that we're making into this neighborhood. And we have a high degree of confidence that the long-term prospects for this neighborhood are going to be significantly better than they would have been otherwise.
And to that point, there was a study done on this Waterman Gardens revitalization and what will occur, done through California Lutheran University. They found that this revitalization will create 667 jobs and generate more than $80 million in direct economic impact to the county of San Bernardino, which is a perfect segue to our guest today, Supervisor Kurt Hagman, who oversees the 4th District of San Bernardino, and we're pleased to welcome him into the show.
Supervisor Hagman, thank you very much for taking time to come by and having a conversation. Appreciate that. Today we're going to explore with the supervisor some of the opportunities and challenges associated with housing and how we as a region might want to think about some solutions and where we go from here. But Supervisor, maybe start out by you went from local government to state government. Now you're back down in local government. Maybe just talk a little bit about your kind of transition and your thoughts about the role, and how's it going?
Oh, first of all, I'd love to be back home. It's nice after 6 years of taking the flight every week to Sacramento. That got kind of old. But I learned a lot up there. I'm learning a lot now as well back in the county level. I think the biggest surprise I see is the bills that we debated on the floor, how they did get distorted through the process and actually come down the regulations when they're finally done. Sometimes completely unintended consequences are there. And, you know, I think the segment we're doing today is a big indicator of that, is the intentions are one way and the actual results are the other. When you have good ideas, he says, hey, you know, let's save a house from fire, let's put sprinklers in, or let's do this. We need to go more green energy. We need to get, you know, all these global, very lofty ideas, when they come to practicality, ends up being always generally about dollars and cents, and someone's paying for it and someone's giving up something for it.
Great. How are you enjoying being at the county? What have you seen as kind of the biggest surprise since you've been at the county?
I love it. There's lots of opportunity right now. It's a great time. I picked the worst time to become a state legislator, when the budgets are going down and we had all our fiscal crisis, and the first 6 months up there is like, why did I do this? I quickly got promoted to the floor leader for our party, Republican floor leader, within 6 months, and I was handed a bunch of responsibility in the worst time. I believe the county's on the other direction right now. All the bad times are over. And the good times are coming back, as far as we look great in housing numbers, and or not in housing numbers, but employment numbers. But things are coming back. And it is a changing economy. We're not going to have a lot of the big box retail anymore. We're going to different kind of shopping, a different kind of jobs market. And so the opportunities to be a policymaker, but actually have some executive roles, again, is a lot different than strictly being a policymaker, not really knowing what's going on when your bills finally get done.
Well, and I would assume being one of five versus one of 80 is a completely different dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're in the legislature with your colleagues 4 days a week, morning until night, here we see each other when we go to meetings or board meetings or committee meetings. But we really have to go back and really be focused on customer service or dealing with our constituents for the most part. And so it's great to be back in that way, but it is definitely different.
So the inland region for decades now has been the primary source of new housing for all of Southern California. And what I would articulate, it's because the coastal region has been irresponsible in providing an adequate supply of housing for the employment that they're generating, and for not only the employees working in those communities, but their own children and grandchildren. And so as we go forward as a region, you know, even our region is struggling to keep up with the demand for housing, especially housing that's affordable. And one of the primary tools we had in order to be able for local government to encourage and incent the housing that they wanted where they wanted it was redevelopment. And so your thoughts about, you know, the impact of the loss of redevelopment on local government, and you know, what are some things we should be thinking about how to meet the needs that we have for housing that's affordable as we go forward?
Yeah, it's a complex situation, to say the least. I voted against the removal of redevelopment and the allotments for the city back when it came up in front of us. But it's, I think, much more complicated than people think. There was cities that had redevelopment and cities that had not. There are pre-Proposition 13 cities and post-Prop 13 cities. So when I served on the League of Cities back in my local government days with the city of Chino Hills, you got exposed to almost every city's finance differently. Now there's definitely things cities want. They want the big retail sellers, you know, car lots, those type of things, big ticket items, because they get more incentive for money for those back to the city than they did in others. But the percentage of property tax is, you know, a major variety from different city to city, what they keep for different things. So it's a mess to begin with. The whole taxation system, the money going from state government back to local government is a mess as well. And it's a bigger problem that has to be addressed. And take it one step further, even sales tax has become more complex. In the old days, you go to your store, you buy something, you get sales tax there. The sales tax helped the infrastructure for the trucks delivering the goods, the police services, the fire protection, all the other city services that used to keep the city going. And now with everything going online, you could have a point of sale location in one part of the state, but all the activity and all the use and the roads and all the need for the services in a completely other one. The whole taxation system in California needs to be addressed and can't be a Band-Aid fix. It needs to be readdressed the whole way. Redevelopment was a way for the state to take some money and give it back to local government and say, both for economic reasons, for housing reasons, here's some tools in your toolbox to hopefully make your community better. When that went away, it left local government with very little, if any, resources to do that. Each year goes by with more regulations that come through and more cost to the to local governments. There's less and less that we could do to be part of the solution, even though we have to deal with all the consequences of the bad policy.
Yeah, and you create a great segue, because one of the challenges that we have, one of the reasons that housing is less and less affordable, is the sheer cost of regulations that continue to be added to development and the production of housing. And they fall into a couple of categories. You know, one of the challenges with affordable housing is we actually build the most expensive housing in any community, because every possible additional cost that can be conceived of, it's added to affordable housing because we're getting some government subsidy. And so, for example, the use of prevailing wage, and the cost of environmental regulations and the cost of energy goals. And do you see any opportunities for a conversation that could reduce the cost side of the equation? And then in a second, we'll talk about the revenue side. But, you know, the costs just seem to keep getting higher and higher.
Yes, and we'll continue with those lofty goals the legislature has that come down to practicality costs, like we talked about earlier. And there's a lot of those. And that is one of the downsides, is everyone wants a piece of the government pie when it comes out. That's why my philosophy is the less we give the state, the better, and the more we keep locally, the better, for the local governments to try to figure out what works for them, and figure out a way to make things happen. But when you do take all those tools out, it makes it much harder for us to make those deals. There, some things have gotten less expensive. You know, when you start doing the same design over and over again, you get some of those soft costs down. But we keep adding more and more to CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, to go through that process takes a long time. We add, like I said, the labor costs are, I think, something that we can address. When that we do or not, it takes the political will or the need to be even more dramatic than it is. And since the housing is more of a regional need, like you said, the beach cities, we aren't going to have a lot of affordable housing needs because the properties are too expensive and people are not going to be able to live there. It comes out to certain areas. And when that we could gather around and have enough political push to push back and say, here's some of the solutions to the problems that we see. And going back to my earlier statement, I really don't think the legislature actually understands half of this when they pass it. It's one thing, I see a big disconnect from theory to practicality when it comes to the bills they pass. The law of special interest groups, we hear about that all the time, really put their different hands into it, but they have that bigger vision, the overall vision of the health of the state or health of the housing market. Is generally something you didn't get into. You got into very specific laser-thin bills that did one particular item or the other. And to put all those pieces of the puzzle together and see what it became is something that most of them don't have the perspective of.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is, you know, the state will take an action. So, for example, the prison release program. without any thought about where are they being released to. And to have a program like that and not ask the question, what about housing, is obviously an incomplete thought. And I mean, just for example, you know, our properties that receive state tax credits, we have a prohibition against felons living in our properties. And so for people being released that might have that kind of a record, they can't even move in with their own families. And that creates that much more challenge from a housing standpoint. But you make a great point about, you know, not thinking through all of the consequences of a particular action.
And I think my commentary on that is it's a result of term limits. We had a long period of time with 6 years, like myself. Just when I start to know what's going on, it's time to move on because my term is up. I'm hoping with the new 12 years in particular office that they can have some knowledge themselves as legislators and less relying on institutional knowledge of staff and trying to see that bigger picture. This does work, this doesn't work, this is our ultimate goal. But as one of my major frustrations I had up there is knowing that bigger picture, seeing the whole thing and trying to figure out working together to come up with the common goals. The goals are not that far apart from Republicans and Democrats. It's the process to get there and put it in the bigger picture.
Sure. And so the challenge, you know, as long as the costs keep getting higher and higher, it does require more subsidy. When redevelopment went away, they took $1 billion a year out of funding to help support affordable housing. And so the speaker recently had AB 1335, a document fee, that would have begun to generate some additional funding for subsidized housing. What's your thought about, you know, ways that we should be thinking about identifying resources as long as the subsidy is needed to be able to provide it?
One of the fascinating things I found when we talked about the cost of government, because you can imagine as the legislative and budget season, almost every person that knocks on your door says we need more money. And very rarely, whether that be a union or, you know, a cause, would they come in and say, let me tell you I can do with my job better, cheaper, you know, with less resources. They always want more. I think it needs to be a comprehensive approach to affordable housing. It's not only where the revenues come from, but really how can you reduce the cost? What things are really necessary? What things are not necessary? And for those that are in the business to go back and say, look, this is your goal, but this is the result. I don't think the goals and results are matching up very well when all the regulations do come through. And a lot of times it's not the legislators, but the departments that take the legislation, interpret it a certain way, and come out the backside and with something completely distorted from what the original goal was. I am very skeptical of sending state money at all. Tony is a dear friend. She was my counterpart on the floor before she became speaker. First of all, I would consider this a tax, not a fee. We're raising dollars from a service that has nothing to do with affordable housing, unless the particular deeds on that. So, you know, let's call it what it is. They're going to tax one thing to help pay for the other. That solves the maybe some of the revenue that was taken away, but really to have a really good sustainable housing market that is affordable is not going to be a $1 billion Band-Aid. We're going to take several billions of dollars over many, many years, and it needs to be a market-driven thing or something locally. Does that mean we take out a lot of the regulations? We take out the you know, the prevailing wage, we take out some of the new green energy codes, do we make the units smaller, more dense, higher built, you know, do we maybe give more property tax credits, less fees at the local level because of what their infrastructure overhead is. It's a comprehensive picture that we have to look at and really see why does this cost as much. Because you should be able to do affordable housing project, maybe not in Beverly Hills or in Santa Monica because of the property values, but if the property is negated, and, you know, hopefully anywhere you need that service, because you do need to have people not driving from Inland Empire to go to L.A. to go to work. You need people who live in L.A. to go to work in L.A. and people live in Inland Empire to find a job in Inland Empire that will sustain their lifestyle. So it's, again, a bigger picture for me. It's not a simple one thing fix or not replace the dollars, even though that is something that is needed and is desirable. And the end result, I agree with, is we do need to build more affordable housing and get these folks into something that can sustain their life. And for me, it's a philosophy of getting them started, hopefully while they're going through school, while they're getting back on their feet, while they're getting the skills to get a better paying job to move on. But it is a bigger picture than what we could do with just this one substitution of fee.
Sure. And one of our philosophies is how do we create a housing environment that is a launching pad into the market, into home ownership, into other opportunities, as opposed to a final destination for a family that's struggling. And we see a lot of families that once they get stabilized have those other opportunities, and to the extent we can continue to encourage that, we think that's a good thing. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what the goal should be. Well, Supervisor Hagman, we very much appreciate you being here today and look forward to the opportunity to work with you. We have a number of properties in your district, and we're excited to be able to continue to explore other opportunities. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for your support.
Well, thank you for having me on, and it's a great time to be part of the San Bernardino team. The future looks good, and we do want to work together to have all the residents bring up their lifestyles and be able to have a good, safe home to go home to every night and be proud of their home.
Great. Very good. And now we'll look forward to the next report from Michael Novogradic.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, the managing partner at Novogradic & Company, LLP. We're a national CPA firm specializing in tax, audit, and consulting services for tax credit-assisted developments, especially multifamily affordable housing. I'm here today to share with you some affordable housing news highlights that were featured over the past month in my weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. If you're ready, let's get started. Let's start off with news about a bill that would create a permanent tax credit percentage floor for the low-income housing tax credit. The bipartisan legislation was introduced by Senators Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington, and Pat Roberts, a Republican from Kansas. The bill text is identical to the House bill that was introduced in February by Representatives Pat Tiberi, a Republican from Ohio, and Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts. Like the House version, the Senate bill would do two things: establish a minimum 9% low-income housing tax credit rate for new construction rental property, and establish a minimum 4% rate for acquisition low-income housing tax credits. The bill would apply to buildings placed in service after December 31, 2014. In a press release, Senator Cantwell highlighted two key statistics that show the effectiveness of the low-income housing tax credit. The first was that each year, the low-income housing tax credit supports more than 90,000 jobs nationwide. The second was that the credit has helped leverage nearly $100 billion in private investment in these critically needed affordable housing units. For these reasons, Senator Cantwell said in the release that this provision must be permanently extended without delay. The bill has been referred to the Senate Finance Committee. At the time of this recording, the Senate bill had 27 co-sponsors and the House bill had 62. I'll be sure to keep you updated in future podcasts. In the meantime, you can find the legislation at www.taxcredithousing.com. The Senate bill is S-1193, and the House bill is H.R. 1142. In other low-income housing tax credit news, the IRS released a memo stating that a building can continue to qualify as low income under Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Code even if an owner terminates a lease due to household income increasing over the amount allowed under the requirements of a local, state, or federal program. The guidance is an important improvement over a similar memo released in 2007, which reached a different, more problematic conclusion. The 2007 memo said that if a taxpayer fails to renew an over-income tenant's lease in order to comply with another program's income requirements that conflict with Section 42, then the property is no longer in compliance with Section 42 and no low-income housing tax credits are allowable in the year under audit. The IRS now recommends that the 2007 memo be withdrawn. It said that auditors should instead determine whether an extended low-income housing commitment is in effect at the end of the tax year or years at issue. However, the new guidance still states that an income increase is not in and of itself good cause to terminate a lease because Section 42 allows a unit to remain qualified as low income even if a tenant's income increases above the qualifying level. There are also instructions for IRS auditors not to be involved in determining good cause evictions, but rather allowing the tenant or allocating agency to enforce those requirements. We've posted the memo for you at www.taxcredithousing.com. Next, I'd like to share a recent report that illustrates the importance of preserving affordable housing resources, such as the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. The report by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, or NLIHC, illustrates the gap between wages and rents across the country. It reveals how difficult it is for renters to remain housed, explaining it using the concept or term housing wage. NLIHC defines housing wage as an estimate of the full-time hourly wage that a household must earn in order to afford a decent apartment at HUD's estimated fair market rent, while spending no more than 30% of income on housing costs. The report indicates that the 2015 housing wage is $15.50 for a one-bedroom unit and $19.35 for a two-bedroom unit. According to the report, the housing wage for a two-bedroom unit is more than 2.5 times the federal minimum wage. Furthermore, the report indicates that there is no state in the country where a minimum wage worker working full-time can afford a one-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent. The federal minimum wage is currently $7.25 per hour. It has not been raised since 2009. Had the federal minimum wage risen alongside productivity, it would be more than $18 per hour today, this according to the report. The report is called Out of Reach 2015. Undoubtedly, working families' low wages and subsequent lack of affordable housing options remains a significant problem across the country. That being said, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit is one of the most prominent tools to help provide affordable housing to the country's low-income earners. To learn more about how programs like the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit can help finance housing for working families, please contact my partner, Stacey Stewart, in our Dover, Ohio office. Well, that brings me to the end of this week's report. For more tax credit news, tune into our weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. It's available on iTunes and on the Novogratz website at www.novogratz.com/podcast. This is Michael Novogratz. Thanks for listening.
So thank you, Jonathan, for another episode of CoreCast. I think it was hopefully a good opportunity to be able to share some of the challenges that we're facing. And one thing I think we would welcome is any feedback from any of our listening audience, either questions or answers about any of the issues that we covered today.
We definitely would, and we'll give you the email address to send those questions to as we close. But as we like to do every week in our final segment, it is the one thing you learned this week. Steve, you first.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to continue to try and understand the challenges that local government is having pulling together the resources necessary to implement the projects that they know are important to their community. And as we go forward, I hope our state and federal representatives will really think about those decisions and those investments that should be directed at the local level and somehow buck the trend of continuing to concentrate more and more of the decisions and resources at the state and federal level.
Yeah, and for me, the one thing this week, I'm really interested in the theory behind how do we solve the problems, especially in our most distressed neighborhoods in our country. And there's good people on, you know, all sides of how do we figure this out? So getting everyone, you know, into the same room, how do we invest in these neighborhoods to help them turn around and to thrive? But how also do we not concentrate poverty? How do we ensure an economic recovery that is good for all, that not just where home prices are close to their peak nationally, but where we don't have a tenth of the nation's zip codes, where the prices are still more than a third below their peak. And, you know, these neighborhoods account for half of the seriously delinquent loans nationwide. How do we turn those neighborhoods around? And I think there's some real answers out there. And so continuing to see how we can work together to do that is something that's of great interest for me.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Steve. And this has been the second episode of CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, one of the nation's largest nonprofit affordable housing developers. We hope you will continue to join us for CoreCast episodes in the future. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and you can also find out more information about our organization at www.nationalcore.org. If you have any comments, suggestions, or questions for us, We'd love to hear from you. Please send an email to jkendrick at nationalcore.org, and we'll be waiting to get back to you. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you again next time.